Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Amy. Wait. Amy. You say you want to hear my confession. Why? Why now, eh? Show yourself. Where are you? Where?
Are you ready, Echo?
Yes. I am ready.
But we have to go back down the hatch. It's the Lost Rewatch Podcast here on Post Show Recaps. Long time since I've said those words. And here we are paying the cost of living. I'm Josh Wigler, joined here by Mike Bloom. Mike, here we are. Finally, it's happened.
Josh, do you hear that echo? Because I don't anymore.
Oh.
I've been sitting on that for 3 weeks.
Oh, really? And over the course of 3 weeks, you still thought that sounded fresh and snappy and good?
Listen, it's been sitting in the fridge for a while. I didn't take a whiff of it. Didn't pass the smell test. But yeah,
it's fine.
Here we are. Yeah. We took a couple of weeks off. I'm so happy to hear your voice again, Josh. Especially talking about a pretty damn good episode of Lost in a stretch of episodes that are not known to be pretty damn good.
Yeah, like we said at the introduction that we recorded to the podcast you did with Ben and John the other week, talking about Lost clones. We really just wanted to emulate the feeling of this first portion of season 3. Like, you're just really stuck in it. It's only 6 episodes, but it feels like it never ends. So we've elongated this period of time by a couple of weeks. Of course, that's not the actual reason why we have been delayed. I appreciate everybody's patience. We back. We're talking about the cost of living. We are saying goodbye to Adewale Akinnoye Ekabaje. And as we hear his Mr. Echo at the end of that introductory clip, I think he was ready for a while. As the story goes, this man wanted to leave Lost, basically from the second his feet touched the ground in Hawaii, to pull in some of the behind the scenes stuff that the great Ben Behind the Curtain collates for us every single week. This from an interview from 2008. With Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse. Damon Lindelof says this was in 2008, that their Mr. Echo plans, they very quickly derailed. Adewale's unhappiness was almost instantaneous. On his second episode, he was already expressing extreme dissatisfaction in a 2011 series of comments on the matter. Damon Lindelof says, in the second season, we started setting all of this stuff up. And around January, Adewale Akinnoye Ekabaje called us and said, I don't want to be in the show anymore. I just hate Hawaii. And we said, dude, we have this huge plan for you and you have a contract. And he said, I don't care. Sue me. I am leaving. So this was something that basically from the moment that Adewale Akinnoye Ekabaje lands on Lost as Mr. Echo, the plans for the character and all of the track that's being laid for him on a story level are apparently being challenged by the fact that the actor does not want to be there. So a lot of the questions of like, how did Mr. Echo, this is so soon, this is so sudden, it feels like completely out of nowhere that we lose Mr. Echo. And like the reality of it on a production level is like, I think we're lucky to have gotten as much Mr. Echo as we got. Or another reality, Mike, is that like we got a lot more Mr. Echo and a very, very like miserable, depressed actor, which nobody wants. I know that this is like a controversial death. This is at the time, it was a very controversial death. It was a really hard loss. This is a character who, it's such a testament to beyond the writing, it's a real testament to the performance. That Adewale is just so excellent in the role that you don't want to lose this man. You don't want to lose this person. He's just imbued so much in the character of Mr. Echo. He is just instantly iconic. Some of those moments that take a while to become iconic, and others are instantly iconic. And Mr. Echo was one of them.
Edge of Echo Extinction.
So I understand why, like, it hurts. It stings. There's a lot of reason it stings. It's a big loss for representation on the show. There is also just like the practical reality that this man didn't want to be there anymore. And so they have to come up with a way to get him off the show when he's a character that they were investing a lot into. So there's a lot of that to unravel, a lot of meta stuff to unravel this week, a lot of like the retroactive things that we like to do of like, okay, knowing the ending of Lost, how do we make this fit within the pantheon? This Mr. Echo arc has always been one that I've enjoyed playing with in that context. So it's an episode I've been very excited to get into due to things that are going on in my personal life. This is also an episode that I have recently been dreading getting to because it's a very difficult way to lose a beloved character, and it is just a little raw for me. But I watched it this morning before you and I hopped on the line, and it was the first episode of Lost I've watched since, I don't know, before August 15th.
So it's in almost a month.
And it was really, really, really good to get back to the island. Just felt great to get back to the island.
No, it's so great talking about. I would almost say a new episode of Lost, but this is a very, very old episode of Lost. And you bring up a lot of very salient points that I think have definitely warped my perspective to the Echo arc of it all. There is my theory going to this, as we discussed with the episode, is that there is one big piece of the Echo arc that I feel like if you remove it, makes his death play much, much better, and we'll get into that. But talking about the AAA of it all, it's so interesting that, in my opinion, he sort of became the Michael of the cast of behind the scenes of Lost, where all he wants to do is get off the island of Hawaii. And he wanted to do it from the very beginning. He was seeing other prospects, and while other people were sort of setting up a home there, he's adamant about, like, I need to get out of here no matter what. Luckily, AAA doesn't turn to the actions that Michael did in order to get what he wanted, and good on him for being able to, I suppose, grin and bear it and put forward a performance that is immaculate, even though he doesn't necessarily like the character. I don't know if this is a hot take. I think this is a fantastic way to end the Echo character. I think it comes down to timing, and I think we're going to get into that in this episode.
Yeah, I think the timing is, is tough, and like, should it have happened at the end of season two? Could it have happened earlier? Maybe. Should it have happened later? Should they have pushed it a little bit? But it happens here, and it happens at the start of John Locke kind of really getting his groove back here in season three.
Oh, he is giddy in this episode.
So I feel like, I don't know. I don't know if there would have been good timing for this. I think like any time you have to accommodate the loss of a cast member for any reason, there is no such thing as a good time. But I think given what is available to them, given the desires that are stated on the board, given the new characters that have emerged in Desmond and Ben and Juliet, I think that the show...
And Nikki and Paula.
I wasn't going to say it. I think that the show does the best job possible with a tough situation. And for me, creates an episode that, at least for me, like a lot of it is like the retroactive headcanoning of the cost of living that enhances it.
Particularly with the monster, right? Because this is another big thing. This is the first time we see the monster in a season plus. This is the first character that the monster outright kills since the pilot. So it is like a pretty monumental episode in terms of that piece of mythology.
Yeah, for sure. You get to see the monster wail on someone, and we have not seen that in a while. It's very aggressive, very hard to watch. Like to literally see like the monster turn into a fist is really, really messed up and scary. So yeah, we're gonna get into all of that. Mike, how you doing? You good?
I'm good. I've been doing well. You know, I think that as much as we missed you last week, I think getting to do the podcast last week with John and Ben, we've heard some fantastic feedback about that. I know that is something that has sort of been in the hopper back when you and I instituted the frozen donkey wheel, which we ruminated on last time we came together. That was one that was always going to be on there. But man, I loved exploring that. I am a television obsessive, if listening to my podcast has not indicated that as of yet. So to take a deep dive into all of these shows that are mostly alien-based, that nearly all failed, and what they had in common was like a great way to sort of reverse engineer if and when, Josh, you and I make Lost 2, and we're trying to figure out what's the special sauce to put on this burger after we killed the cow, bake the bread, etc.
Yeah.
I think we figured it out.
Try rendering animal fat. It's really, really tough. But we're gonna render the fat here on the cost of living, back on the grind for the weekly episodic crawl through Lost. Of course, get your feedback in down the hatch at PushaRecaps.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter at Round Howard, at A Mike Bloom type. With all of that said, let's go forth into the jungle for the cost of living, directed by Jack Bender, prolific director, producer of Lost. It's written by Allison Shapker and Monica Owusu-Breen. This is the only writing credit for the both of them. This originally aired November 1st, 2006. It is the third and final Mr. Echo flashback. Any thoughts that you want to put on the table before we dive in, Mike?
Let me just, as I just mentioned before, I think there is one key piece of the Echo arc, particularly in season three, that sort of obscures, I think, or colors the thoughts about how soon his death comes. So let me just cast this thought before we go into it. Imagine watching this episode where the Bear Cave story arc from episode three doesn't happen. That further instructions doesn't happen, and that Echo just got found and taken back to the shelter. Because my personal thought is, when you remove that, it makes this overall arc and this episode in particular ring much, much deeper.
Are you asking me, would Lost be better without further instructions? Because, I mean, probably, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think the issue is, and not to belabor the point, since I know we want to get into the summary, but for me, it's not even that Echo... I realize that for me, it's not that Echo dies in season three, episode five. It's that Echo dies in season three, episode five. And in season three, episode three, he's almost nearly at death's door anyway in a bear cave where John Locke finds him.
So we're just extending the goalposts on it.
Sort of. But that's, it's also like, if we're going with the football analogy, it's like, oh, we almost scored the touchdown. Let's wait a couple downs. Okay. Now we scored the touchdown. It feels like it's not necessarily bringing the impact of it, because we already sort of had that near-death scare two episodes ago.
I guess maybe there's the consideration that it makes Mr. Echo's death more surprising because he's just escaped it twice, right? Like, he survived the hatch blowing up.
Is why do you need the bear cave then if he's already survived the hatch exploding?
Because, like, if he survives it twice, it's like, they're not going to get him on the third one, but they do. I think, like, let's say there's the perfect world where Lost is perfect. In the perfect world where Lost is perfect, I think they figure out a way for Mr. Echo to stay on the show, but we're not living in that world. So let's get into a world where season three isn't doing some of, its season three isms, which, you know, for my money, I think that it's very Losty, which is why I like it from a historical, perspective. I think maybe Further Instructions is a totally different episode, and maybe you wait for Mr. Echo's return to be all contained within the Mr. Echo episode. Yeah. I think that there's definitely something to that. I think Further Instructions is a really flawed episode of the show, as we've discussed. So, you know, the question is, like, would Echo's death resonate better without, like, the polar bear stuff? My instinct is probably yeah. Especially because one of the things that I find impactful about the cost of living is how Echo is in such rough shape the entire way through. This is, you know, this is like the guy who's like wandering through the final moments of his life. He's like, you know, like being visited by ghosts of the past and confronting his history. And he himself, who has this history of violence, is wearing that violence so profoundly.
Like that, a tattered shirt.
You know, well, the shirt's actually, this is his least tattered shirt on an island, I think. I think that that's powerful. But I think you could probably still do that by the fact that he just like got wrecked by the explosion in the hatch.
Exactly.
Both explosions, like the explosion and the implosion of the hatch.
the explosion and the implosion. I didn't realize he was involved in both forms of plosion.
You know, well, there was the dynamite and then there was the hatch going kablooey. So yeah, or kapurpley, I guess. so like maybe that's better, than having him have to weather the polar bear as well. Yeah, you know, you don't have to work too hard to convince me that this would be better without the polar bear stuff.
Yeah, so I just wanted to sort of throw that out there that maybe this means I'll bump further instructions down even further in retrospect when it gets to the end, because like, oh, and you ruined the Mr. Echo death too. Damn you, episode 3.
I definitely don't think it ruins the Mr. Echo death for me.
No, like, I don't think so. But I think if you happen to be watching these from a sort of sequential perspective, I do think the death itself, the surprise of the death, gets a bit, I don't know, mired slightly by the fact that, okay, we already had this incident happen 2 episodes ago. That being said, I can't wait to get into that final scene, because I think it is a beautiful way to send off the character. I know people have thoughts about it, but I think it's a very touching scene.
I think this is a really, really great episode. I you know, a lot of this is emotionality, but I'm giving it a 4.2. Just preemptively, like I needed Lost back in my life at the time that I came to this episode this week. But I think beyond that, this has been one of the episodes that I think about the most. This is one of the episodes that mentally I return to the most. I think it's a great example of how to creatively pivot while also still like giving someone who you had invested so much into a really great send off, despite the fact that you don't want to let that person go. I just think that there's a lot of here there, and like beyond the Echo stuff, the Hydra Island stuff is maybe the best Hydra Island stuff we've gotten in the season so far.
I mean, listen, it's a low bar.
It's a low bar, but like it's great. It's great, the Hydra Island stuff, I think. So let's get into all of it. I'm going to go through this part a little bit quickly because I want to come back to it. You know, the episode begins with a flashback, and it's Echo and Yemi as kids. And Echo and Yemi have stolen crackers from a shed, cause they're hungry, they're starving. And a nun comes and she scolds Echo, says like, you gotta confess that you've stolen. Even young Echo is defiant and says like, it doesn't matter. He was hungry. Yemi was hungry. This isn't bad. And she says, you've no excuse. You've sinned. The fact that he's hungry doesn't matter. Go ask God for forgiveness. Confess. And there's the priest whose legs are behind the curtain.
Yeah, Muppet Baby style.
Muppet Baby style.
Are we assuming this is the same church that Yemi and Echo will eventually inherit? Looks like very similar set dressing.
Certainly looks like it. I don't mean to breeze past it, but I want to talk about that in conjunction with one of the final images we get in this episode. So let's put a pin in it. Young Echo and Yemi are established. Let's talk about them when we see them again at the very end of the episode. We then open on an eye, because of course we open on an eye, and it's poor Mr. Echo who's just having a hard time. Saeed is back. Echo has apparently been like this for a couple of days, and he's like, Charlie, what happened to Mr. Echo? Charlie's like, oh, before or after the polar bear? To your point.
It is really interesting that we sort of like yada yada through Saeed and the Kwans returning. Are we assuming that they just hoofed it back to camp, considering that they have no boat?
Well, they say that Echo's been like this for a couple of days now. So a couple of days have passed, and Saeed said it's going to take us a couple of days to get back. And I think like the timing on that bears out from when Sawyer and Kate are going to come back from Hydra Island as well. So I see no problem with that. I think the fact that a couple of days have passed works for me.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that, obviously, you assume that Saeed would also disclose what happened, or do you think he would be fairly close to the chest about the fact that the first son killed another, and also the others robbed them of the boat?
Yeah, nobody tells anybody anything on the island, so you gotta imagine he just kept that to himself.
Yeah, I can imagine secrets are really just locked tight in a vault.
Yeah, and I think like there are trust issues with the people who are here. You know, we'll talk about the vacuum of Jack in this episode, the Count Jaculum. Whoa, that sounds terrifying.
Oh no, I'm staying away from that one.
Yeah, stick away. You don't want anything to do with that. I think that how that has impacted things is something worth exploring. We get everybody leaves the tent. We start getting like this montage to remind us of the Echo arc of like his childhood, of shooting the man to save Yemi, becoming Mr. Echo, Yemi dying on the tarmac. All of that, and it leads to a ghost arriving in Echo's tent. And let's listen in. Sound number one.
Echo, wake up. It is time to confess. To be judged, brother. I will be waiting. You know where to find me.
The guy smells smoke.
Oh!
Get this man! Echo! Help me! Go!
Echo, Echo,
leave him on.
We gotta get out of here.
Cover him with this. Careful,
the
careful.
Hot. Careful.
Laying down. Laying down.
You okay? All right. My brother. Brother.
You're all right.
It's okay.
Okay.
Brother.
You're all right. I'll be back.
Charlie!
Is everyone okay?
Yeah, we're good.
Where's Echo?
Hurley and I, hold him out. Over.
He's right there. Echo? Echo?
Now, Mike, Damon Lindelof has said that a lot of the story that they had originally planned for Mr. Echo went to Benjamin Linus and went to Desmond.
I wonder which part went to Desmond here.
Is that why Mr. Echo is saying, brother, brother?
Yeah,
and
I wondered
Desmond
if,
goes on to say brother every other word as he becomes a huge star on the show.
I wish that Desmond had been part of that scene instead of Charlie so we could get like a who's on first type of thing. Like, brother, yes? What do you want?
Are you my brother, brother? Yeah.
I think also at this point, we are 3 for 3 in terms of fires at this camp. Should they appoint a fire marshal amongst 815? Because they're really having a problem with that.
Absolutely. I don't know who they want to elect, but they definitely want to have a fire marshal.
Dude, that has Rodney Sesto's name all over it.
No, he's a fire starter, that dude. I included the full clip of the tent going up and Echo disappearing. You know, the Echo disappearing part mostly for the brother bit, because that's funny. But the second that we cut away from Yemi in there with Echo, you hear Hurley saying, "Do you smell smoke?" And so that to me makes it unambiguous that the Yemi we are dealing with in the tent with Mr. Echo is the smoke monster. That this is obviously the smoke monster is going to be creeping throughout the entire episode. But I know we've had some debate about, is this the island as Yemi? Is this the smoke monster as Yemi? And I have held to the belief that every time we have seen Yemi in instances like this, it's the smoke monster. I hold to that belief, and I especially hold that the Yemi that we're seeing in this moment, who's saying, "You're coming to be judged, you're coming to me to confess, to Echo," that is very much the smoke monster.
And I like it more that, because I agree that Yemi's definitely smoky in this episode, but I like it more if it wasn't smoky the previous two times, because that means that the smoke monster is purposely taking whatever Jacob and the island is providing to Echo in the form of this vision quest and bastardizing it and manipulating it, right? Maybe it's his use of a prop
that's interesting.
That now he's flicking a lighter.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's interesting. That's interesting. Because, you know, one of the things that, like, on like the mythological level that people, I think, have some issue with is that Echo's a candidate, right? I think he's like number 76 on the wall, something like that. I think we have that written down somewhere. Yes, Echo is candidate 76, according to Ben Martell. But we see that Jacob is able to scratch candidates off the list before they die, as he did with Kate. Kate was 51. He crossed her off. You became a mom. You can't possibly be the leader of the island. Cancel Jacob. I think that there could be the argument that, I think one of the things that I feel strongly about in this episode, that this episode expresses, contrasted against the greater scheme of Lost, is where for many people, what happens here on the island is the most important time in their lives. And it's why those people build the church together at the end of the show and find each other there.
Plus the fact that they owe Yemi a church.
Echo is absent from that. Obviously, it's because Adewale doesn't want to come back to Lost. Maybe there's, some grievances between parties involved. Who knows? That's speculative. That I think that the most important time in Echo's life did not happen on the island. And my feeling could be that, like, even without your interpretation of it, that Yemi was the island, like, working through him a couple of times, that there could have been instances where Jacob, having summoned Echo to the island, basically sizes Echo up and, like, intuits that Echo's importance is not related to here, whether mm-hmm. or not, like, great man, bad man, whatever, Echo's destiny is not about protecting this place. Cross him out. But I like your idea that maybe, like, the island stuff is sussing that out to a degree as well. So I think that there's room for both interpretations for sure.
And we assume, no matter who it is, that with Yemi flicking the lighter, that it was Smokey who started the fire.
Yeah, I think so. It was always burning, though, is an important note about the fire. Yeah, I think so. So we'll get into all of that. Echo's gone. He's gone off into the jungle, much like we have. Let's go to Hydra Island, where Jack is getting prison jacked. He's doing pull-ups. Benjamin walks in, funny exchange where he wants him to go for the walk. And Jack says, you say that like you're not just going to throw a bag over my head if I say no. And Ben says, then don't say no. I always love that line read from Michael Emerson. He's like, then don't say no. He's just like, yeah, you're totally right. We'll just throw a bag over you.
Yeah. And I also love, Jack at this point is pretty much on to, exactly what's been going on and why he's being brought there. It's going to get confirmed to him in this episode. But I also love the double entendre of him telling Ben, I'm ready whenever you are,
mm-hmm.
Because it is a term of like, yep, I'm good to go. But it also sort of hints to Ben of like, hey, I know what's going on with you. You keep trying to be Mr. Catty and sort of, be purposely withholding, but like, put your cards out on the table. I'm ready whenever you are if you want to talk.
Yeah, so he lists it out, right? Like he calls his bluff. He's like, does your neck hurt? Is there any mm-hmm. numbness in your fingers, your toes? You've got a tumor, buddy. It's an aggressive tumor. It's going to kill you.
Not a tumor.
Unless those x-rays were very recent, it's not going to be very long before you stop taking walks, is what he tells Ben. And Ben's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Ben does not like to be busted. And he's totally busted here.
Mm-hmm.
And he busts himself even further when he gives Jack the white shirt and they go in all of their white shirts. Everybody's rocking the white. I assume that this takes place before Labor Day.
I'm trying to remember. I mean, it's only a couple months after 815 crash, so they're probably into probably December or November at this point.
They're in
right?
November for sure. Yeah, this is a violation.
But I believe it's interesting because you could say at one perspective, like, they're doing Jacob cosplay.
Yep.
And that this is like a sacrifice to Jacob. But I guess tied into that, I know that Lostpedia more so described it as, the traditions of Hindu funeral practices are that white instead of black is actually the funeral color. And so it would make sense, given the name of the Dharma Initiative and the number of Eastern practices that are sort of brought over, hashtag namaste, could also make sense that, like, in the Bible, quote unquote, of the Dharma Initiative, white is the appropriate color for funerals.
Yeah, and that this is, like, something that they've adopted from Dharma. And I think speaks to sort of like the multicultural, multi-faith idea that's certainly at the core of the ending of Lost. I think is interesting. They play "I Wonder" by Brenda Lee as they're shipping Colleen off, Viking funeral style.
Why do you think that Ben invited Jack to the funeral?
I think he's still doing what he thought he was doing. I think that he was still like, I want to slowly indoctrinate the doctor into our culture and make him realize we're not so bad. And then he's got Sawyer and Kate on standby in case he needs to squeeze those triggers. And I don't think that at this point he knows that Jack is aware that Ben has the tumor. And so when Jack, you know, plays that card, it really surprises Ben to the point that Juliet shows up here, and Juliet, who hates funerals, she's like, hey, look at your shirt, goes over to Ben, and Ben says, why did you show Jack the x-rays? She's like, I didn't tell him that they were yours. I guess you just did. And Jack is watching. And like, that's all the confirmation in the world that he needs at that point. Mm-hmm. So I think that Ben has brought Jack out because he's still his plan that got shot to sunshine. He doesn't know that it's been shot to sunshine yet.
Yeah. And I think I wonder that just because of like what he does in the last episode, which is, you know, handcuff Jack to the gurney of dead Colleen because he wants him to, you know, see what he did and be punished appropriately for it. To your point, this feels distinctly different. It feels less so that Ben's like, feel bad for the fact that this woman died on your watch. It does seem more so like, no, we're bringing you into our community so you'll be able to toss a football with Mr. Friendly later.
Exactly.
But yeah. But even that line of, I didn't tell them they were yours, but I guess you did, is a great hint also of the growing insubordination that has been there the entire time. We just haven't seen it personally, that we're really going to get from Juliet in this episode.
Juliet's so good in this episode. Juliet and Jack are both just outstanding. Like, what Jack has done here is really, really, really terrific.
Yeah, I mean, he's on them. Say what you want to, again, about his leadership or the annoying chain pulling that occurred in episode one, but like, he's onto their game right now.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so the next day, we're back on the beach. It's Locke, Saeed, and Desmond. What a great trio.
I don't know. Saeed might disagree because he asked flat out in front of Desmond why he needs to be there.
He's going to come around on Desmond. I mean, he's a big part of the constant. You know, never forget that Saeed is there for all of the constant.
But speaking of callbacks, I do love that when Saeed asks that question, Desmond responds with, "Is that supposed to hurt my feelings?"
Yeah.
Which, you know, Saeed, he's not that wall. His feelings are getting hurt still.
That wall is long gone. So Desmond tells Saeed, I think that the computer, it was more than just pushing the button. I think you could use it to communicate. And so Locke thinks like, all right, well, we can find another hatch and communicate to the others and barter for our friends that way. And this is when Hurley and Charlie show up. They're wondering about where's Mr. Echo. And he's like, oh, we don't have any clues. All he was doing was saying, brother, brother. And Desmond's like, oh, brother. And Locke knows all about Yemi. And he has this eureka moment of, all right, everybody's going to the same place. Let's head to the Pearl. That's where Echo's going. Two birds, one stone.
Yeah, what I do like about this as well, between the three Echo flashback episodes, are that it is all centered around one central location, that being the location of the Beechcraft / ironically enough, right above the Pearl, that this is always going to be sort of Echo's location, in a manner of speaking, which, you know, we're actually about to get into the flashback, which I would say, you know, I'm going to sort of co-opt what I said about question mark in that I feel like this flashback, there are actually a couple of revelations that I realized after the fact that don't exactly make it a complete nothing burger, no matter how hard you worked on it. But I will still say it definitely still pales in comparison to what happened with the 23rd Psalm. But at least all of this action and characterization around Echo, whenever he has the center of attention, is focused around one central location, as opposed to what we've been talking about with characters throughout season three, which are like the flashbacks and the characters location wise are all over the place.
I think I see the utility to this flashback in that Echo is about to die and he is about to reflect on all of the things that he has done in his life that got him to where he is now. And that there is worthiness in exploring how did Echo grieve and react and live in the grief of the immediate aftermath of what happened to Yemi? Because I think that the episode strongly argues that Yemi is Echo's constant. That the most important time in Echo's life was everything threaded through Yemi. That Echo's entire life is threaded through this one person. That if Lost is a love story, that the ultimate story about Echo is not about love of God, which is as it presents, you know, about a man who's deeply devout and has so much faith, but is a different kind of love story than the one you often see on this show, which is the love between siblings. That it's the love for your brother, that he is his brother's keeper, and that he values that so deeply in himself, that that's his constant. That's his core tenet. That's the thing that is his ultimate guiding star. So I think as we're losing the character, watching him lose himself, regress, I don't know. There's complicated emotional stuff that's going on with Echo as, yes, we go to this flashback and we see that, you know, there's this beautiful music that guides him back into the church, and he sees the photo of himself and Yemi as boys, and it's just so sad. And this is where Echo is going to take on Yemi's role at the church because of this, like, case of, you know, confused identity, and also him seizing an opportunity. Like, that's the Echo he's become. And I think the flashback is sort of reconciling those two identities for him. What is the transition for Echo from being, you know, the guy who had to become a warlord because he protected his brother versus becoming somebody that his brother could maybe be more openly proud of? So I think that the flashback that we see starting with that scene here resonates with me as far as what's the final mission statement for Mr. Echo as a character.
I think that what really resonates for me about this flashback personally is the idea of, even when Echo tries to, you know, stray down a path of what he should do, he's still going to be Echo at the end of the day. That is to say, he's still going to cut off a guy's arm. That warlord is still a part of him. And it sort of does also ingrain this lesson of, you can push all you want to become someone that you should be, but at the end of the day, you are the person that you are. And so, you know, the ending in this flashback in particular is very interesting, because it's not a happy ending for Echo in this flashback. He gets this church boarded up. He chops down the tree, but the roots are still there. There's still a very big crime problem in his town. And I think him sort of realizing that is so very interestingly jarring to how the character ends, which is almost like on a happy note, where he makes his confession and basically is like, I don't regret anything that I did, which is, you know, it's interesting to pair those two. I will definitely put this above the question mark flashback, which I still feel was
no
was
doubt. It's not
pretty,
even a contest.
Pretty inessential in terms of teaching this. I do think it was interesting to, like, you know, go from that back to right after the events of the 23rd Psalm. You know, it's clear, obviously, that they came up with this stuff after the writing question mark, but you'd have to hope and wonder that they could have possibly switched it to just go in chronological order. But yeah, I agree. Staying in Nigeria, I think, is the better choice for the character.
So Echo is waking up in the jungle. We see, like, the wisps of the smoke monster flittering around. Echo's doing his level best to move through the jungle. The jungle has other plans. Here are the ghosts, right? Here are all the people he's going to kill later in the episode. We're, like, sort of repeating all of that. So if this is, this comes down to this question of, like, what can the monster do, right? Can the monster make you hallucinate? Can the monster pull visions out of you if it, like, assesses you the way that it assessed Echo earlier on in the series? I would vote yes. I would vote that this is all part of, like, trying to push him closer and closer to this place where he is going to basically pledge undying loyalty to the monster. I think that that's what the monster wants. Just to put, like, you know, a point on that, because I don't think that we've, like, been explicit in our discussion of the episode yet of, like, well, we know that Yemi is the smoke monster, so why is he coming for Echo? I think in the grand scheme of things, the thing that I've argued for a while is that the smoke monster, we know, is going to want somebody to like, do the things that he needs to be done in order for himself to be freed. And he's going to have to lock into place to somebody's physical form at a certain point in time. And that John Locke is going to be that guy ultimately. That John Locke is going to be the guy that the smoke monster determines is, whether gullible or fallible or whatever it is, if he's enough of a sucker that he'll fall for the con. That I think that the monster is assessing these possibilities within Echo as well, knowing Echo's past, knowing what Echo has been through, knowing what Echo represents to the people of this community, may represent to the people of this community. Is Echo another viable alternative for somebody that he could pick? And I think that it probably, again, this is all like the fan fiction-y shit,
right?
You know, which I just think makes Lost richer. If it's not your bag, it's not your bag. You know, there is the fact that he's not a candidate anymore. So now he's at death's door physically. He's not a candidate anymore. So Echo is either a huge asset or a tremendous threat. If Echo is not going to do whatever the monster wants Echo to do, then Echo left alive is a very dangerous person for what the monster ultimately wants to do. Mm-hmm. So while Echo is in this weakened state, this feels like a moment for the monster to be like, all right, so who's he going to be? Is he going to be my guy or is he going to be my victim? Like, is this going to, I mean, he's going to be his victim either way, but is he going to be a victim that serves him and helps him? Or is he going to be somebody that he's going to have to murder right now before he regains some strength? And he chooses door number two because of Echo's choices. That is how I've always viewed this. We're getting pretty early into the he said we're next stuff. I've always interpreted, or at least since we've gotten the smoke monster is a guy reveal, I have interpreted that as Echo said, you're next to,
yep, and
to
John said, oh, of course, the royal you. You must yes. mean we all are yes. next, including Nikki and Paulo.
That is what how I've interpreted it ever since we've learned that the correct question wasn't what is the smoke monster, but who is the smoke monster?
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think it makes that much richer as well, especially given Echo's, albeit limited, role in all this, but definitely the importance of the character, especially near the end of season two, when John has that weakness of faith and Echo quite literally takes over in his spot. I also wonder, in the perennial battle between Jacob and the Man in Black, is this some sort of posturing as well of like, yeah, you think this guy could have taken over? Look at what I can do to him. See, he's not worthy. None of these candidates are worthy. I'm going to get free here and you can't do anything
right.
about it.
I
think it could also be a bit of a, you know, a jockeying for position as well between these two guys that are essentially, once again, as we talked about before, playing chess or playing Senate with these pieces of people.
You can imagine like the deleted scene where the monster goes to the four-toed statue and sits down for fish with Jacob and is like, you should really think twice about who you decide to cross off your list because
yep.
I, you know, as soon as you're done, as soon as you've deemed this person's not a candidate, I could just rip them to shreds. Look at Mr. Echo. Like there is sort of like the unseen, monster Jacob stuff to consider. And I think like I can fully imagine that this is the smoke monster puffing its smoky chest, at Jacob and being like, you made a mistake by crossing this guy off. Look at what I've just done.
Not only that, that's also a really fun, delicious parallel to brothers. And that's maybe another reason why the Man in Black seeks out the form of Yemi, because he knows firsthand how simultaneously like complicated yet nefarious a pair of brothers can be, especially when they don't see eye to eye. Of all the people he probably associates with the most right now, it's Mr. Echo.
Yeah.
It's this guy who turned bad, had a brother who, like, you know, chastised him for the way that he saw things and it was sort of at odds with him for a while. Like, he sees himself in Echo. In a manner of speaking.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
There's another interesting association there.
Yeah, because I think, like, you know, the crux of Lost, obviously, is, like, all of these people are people who do not want to be here. And by here, I don't just mean the island, but also, like, where they are in their lives.
Right.
And Echo is a great example of that, of somebody who, like, who does not want to be where he is in his life, faking his way through being a priest, or, like, wishing that he had come by it, like, more authentically, even though he's going to reject that notion. You know, like all of the pain that he's gone through, wishing that he had gotten to a place in life where his brother hadn't died, that he feels his brother's death is on his hands, wishing he wasn't here in all of that pain and all of that grief. And you can apply that idea to just about every single character on Lost, Jack wishing that he and his father hadn't gotten so strained to the point that his dad drank himself to death, feeling like that's on him. Kate wishing that like she could just stop running. She can't.
Yep.
She's here. All of that, you know, on and on and on you go. But I do think that one of the unique qualifiers about Echo is exactly this idea of brotherhood that is so foundational to his character and is the central crux that he is going through. And maybe once upon a time for the man in black, that was his mom. That was the Allison Janney character. But she's been dead for a very long time. And not that that is not something that is probably still like torturing him, but Jacob is an active presence on the show. Jacob killed him. Jacob killed him.
Jacob put him in this crazy form that he exists in.
You know,
today.
Jacob killed him and then locked him in a cage. And so he understands like the pain and suffering that you can have tied up in a sibling, whether it's a sibling rivalry or your love and your misunderstanding of like why did your brother judge you like this? And Yemi was always very harsh towards Echo's lifestyle and not understanding of the circumstances that they found themselves in, or at least not allowing that to land as a justification for the way that Echo has chosen to behave. So I think in Mr. Echo, aside from the fact that like if your choice is like, do you want to be like bald 60-year-old John Locke forever or like super sexy badass Mr. Echo for the rest of your life? You lock into Mr. Echo if that is like if that is an option, I think. But there's also, I think you're totally right. I think when he examines Mr. Echo in that moment back in the 23rd Psalm, I think he is seeing so much in that character that resonates so deeply within his own journey, which probably is a big piece of why he's so viciously angry at Mr. Echo by the end of this episode and kills him the way that he does.
Yeah, because he really is sort of like, he doesn't need to tease him along the way that he does, right? He could easily get him out in the jungle, transform into Smokey, and then just beat the ever-loving crap out of him. But he really leads him along.
It's disappointing. It's like bitter. It's a very bitter pill.
Yeah, he's leading him along, almost like dragging out his torture by being like, look at what you could have been, and look at what you've shied away from. And as a result, I'm sorry, but I have to do this. What I do find interesting is as we sort of get these, you know, these ghosts of the past that Echo is looking at, we do see the Ultra Boy Daniel, who does the same motion, the shushing, that Walt did to Shannon during the infamous visions that he did in season 2. So, was Walt the smoke monster?
Holding up the moth right now. Yeah, whatever. Who knows? Maybe. On my Animal Crossing island, Walt is a kangaroo.
Oh, I love that. Well, I guess hopefully not a bird. I'm just glad he's not a bird.
No. He took on an Australian animal as his likeness, however. All right, so back at the beach, Locke's going to invite everybody for the party. And Hurley's like, what?
He's so freaking chipper.
Yeah,
he's like, well, I'm going to go find Echo. Does anybody want to come with me? Like, this is... You're talking about John Locke getting his groove back. Like, he is in such good spirits. Yeah. John Locke would never... Think about season 1 when he's like, I'm taking Boone and Boone only into the middle of the jungle. Now he's like, all right, plus ones for everybody.
Yeah, everybody gets plus ones. John Locke is flush with cash. Or at least he's just like got that
John
that
Locke
energy.
Ralphio.
Yeah, John Ralphio Locke. So he's going to invite everybody. You know, Hurley has the great line of like, Jack used to only go with Saeed or Kate. And he goes, well, I'm not Jack. Here come Nikki and Paolo, and they're going to be along for the ride here. And I know that's a thing.
Yeah.
Paolo especially really sucks in this episode.
He
more
really
so than Nikki,
does.
I think. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, because let's also look about this canonically in retrospective expose, because at this point, Paolo found the diamonds, didn't tell Nikki about them, and hid them in the toilet at the Pearl Station. And that's why that's when he observes, you know, Ben and Juliet looking in on the computer. So Nikki at this point has all but like given up at finding the diamond. So she's like, yeah, sure, I'll go along. Like, yeah, I might as well. And Paolo's the one who really doesn't want to go at first because he knows what's there. But he decides to sort of tag along. But yeah, God, he's such like a little chode in this episode.
He really is. He's terrible. Oh, I hate him so much in this episode. Yeah, so they're going to meet at the tree line in 10 minutes. Desmond's asking Locke, are we going for the computer? Are we going for your man? Are we going for Echo? And Locke points out, it's two birds with one stone. We're all going to the same place. Desmond says, quite a coincidence. Locke says, don't mistake coincidence for fate.
And the transition's complete. Now yes. Echo Band had the ball for a portion of time when it comes to the faith of the island, but now Locke has that ball back and then some.
He's picked it back up. All right, so Echo goes to the river's edge. He plops down. He takes a sip. We get a flashback. And here comes Amika. Amika and his posse, they're here. They protect the village in exchange for 80% of vaccine from the Red Cross. But of course, the protection is we're protecting you from us.
Yeah. So Amika, on the surface of watching this the first time, I was sort of like, okay, fine. Insert, you know, generic Nigerian thug here. But what I looked up, and I forgot about, I forget if we talked about this when we first looked up Mr. Echo in the series Bible, whether that was real or fake. But Amika was originally the name of Echo's character. And so I think if you actually look at this character as two-dimensional as he is, as Echo coming face-to-face with the version of the past that he is now trying to escape, it's actually a really interesting story, especially the way that Echo deals with it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I really don't care for this character. For a couple of reasons, but there was a time where like I didn't like the character because I thought that like this was a badly written character and like this was like a gaffe on the writer's part of like, how is this guy like King Shit and he doesn't know who Mr. Echo is, who is also King Shit? Sorry, I just sucked in air the wrong way.
Give me oh no! Is it smoke?
Oh god. Oh man. We're leaving that in. All right. We're going to leave that in, everybody. I almost died for you on a podcast.
Welcome back. Here's Josh's coughing fit.
Oh, God. I swear I'm live. I don't need vaccine. I'm good. What works for me, though, is Mr. Echo being actually King Shit in this world and Amika being like, you know, the true Amika is the one who is shown in his final moments of please don't kill me, please don't kill me. It's like, this guy bit off a lot more than he could chew. This dude didn't even know who Mr. Echo was.
And that's how Echo sees him, right? It's like, yes. I believe when he just saw them in the jungle, we saw the montaned armless man, but I believe Amika was hiding behind him, like cowering. Yeah. And yeah, that's the thing is that he's this guy that thought there was a power vacuum, stepped up into it and realized that, hey, maybe these boots are a bit too big.
Yeah, so fair enough. So I think that works. I think that works as far as the Amika character, that he is viewed by Echo as somebody who's just like cruel for the sake of cruelty, no thought behind it. Like, I think in Echo's mind, at least there was always something bigger, like maybe his reputation was saving his brother. The deeper he was going into this world, the more protected Yemi was, no one would dare touch Mr. Echo's brother. I think also a certain degree of borrowing from the title of the show, getting lost in the avatar of Mr. Echo and the world of Mr. Echo, of what he was becoming. But I think he looks at Amika and he's like, you are not King Shit. You are to be flushed. And I think like just like no respect for this character at all, especially when Amika just like shoots the person. Yeah. And he says, I'm coming back on Friday. And Echo's like, cool, do that.
Yeah, well, it's very, also kind of looking forward to season four, right? If here's Echo and here's Ben both being like, you're not going to do that. I've been through this. I know what posturing is. But no, they end up killing somebody. And as much as we talk about how Amika sort of ends up cowering at the end of the day, this is a character who right now is extremely confident in, you know, what he's able to swing around. And yeah, I do think that a lot of the crux of this flashback comes from how does Echo approach a problem when he is trying to sort of take the noble path? And the answer is he can't help but sort of solve it how he knows how to solve problems at this point, which is not in a very biblical way, or actually maybe in a biblical way, considering how graphic the Bible is.
So we come back from that and the smoke monster is like, hey, buddy. What you got going on down there? The smoke monster creeping on Echo.
Yeah, hey, you got a little dirt there, and by there I mean everywhere.
Yeah, he's just like smearing dirt all over himself. If this is what you're supposed to do to survive in the wild, I mean, this was not a surprise. I'm dead in the wild.
You know, so you draw the line at smearing mud on yourself?
No, it's not that I draw the line or that I'll do that. I don't understand necessarily the utility of smearing mud on your bandaged wound. You know, especially because it's all like he's smearing it on the bandage. I don't really know what it is that he's doing here.
Maybe he's like making like some sort of mud pie to like stick down the bandage.
Maybe. I don't know. Someone weigh in. Survivalists. Not Survivor fans. Survivalists. You could be a Survivor fan too. We would love to know. We would love to know. Locke, who said like everybody at the tree line in 10 minutes, literally like 1.5 scenes ago, is now here.
Yeah. And so he, him and Echo would just sort of do like a little bit of a nod, you know, at each other coming together. I would say again, this would have a lot more meaning if they had come, if they had not come together during the bear cave scene, but here they are staring eye to eye again.
Really doesn't bother me that much, but I totally understand. I'm not going to argue that the polar bears in Further Instructions were instrumental to the greater Echo arc. You could take her. I could leave the poor man who's the stunt man whose name I now forget.
Oh no,
who played the polar bear? Oh my god! All right, let's go to Hydra Island. Lunchtime, kids. All right, Juliet's made some jelly sandwiches and sliced up some cantaloupe, but this is what she's actually made. Let's listen in. Sound number two.
You want to guess what's for lunch?
I'm not big on mysteries.
Of course you're not.
You people have cheeseburgers?
You have no idea what I went through to make this for you. I killed the cow, processed the meat, baked the bun, and the fries. Try rendering animal fat.
No ketchup?
That is an incredible scene. I mean, and that's just like the tip of a greater scene. Like this whole scene is incredible, and it begins with this really, really funny exchange between Jack and Juliet. Just an incredible series of line reads from Elizabeth Mitchell here.
I mean, they're both of them. Like, I love Jack's finisher.
No ketchup.
Like it's actually I ship them. There's some good interplay between the two here. And I also will say that cheeseburger, no matter where it came from, looked pretty damn delicious.
It looked really good. It really
looked
did.
Really good.
You know, and I'm like kind of a burger snob. I think like my hot take on food is that the burger is the most overrated food item. That like a bad or mediocre burger just like is not worth touching. And I would say a fast food burger is in its own different category. And then you grade the fast food burgers because sometimes there's just nothing like the 99 cent burger from McDonald's. Mm-hmm. Not an advertiser here on this week's Down the Hatch. But I think like I want like a good beefy meaty burger with the bun that looks good. All of the boxes are ticked here in this burger that Juliet has painstakingly created, and we should just take her at her word, right? That this is literally what she did. She took a cow from like Mikhail's farm at the mm-hmm. flame station.
Maybe when he was peeking in, it's like right after he dropped off the cow with Juliet, mm-hmm. and he just happened mm-hmm. to look into the camera. I mean, that's the thing. We've seen Juliet all over the place in the past five episodes. I can only assume she knows how to do everything.
We know that she's a baker. She did burn her muffins, but that was probably partly because of grief.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And rendering animal fat, who's to say that she doesn't have some sort of, like, rendering plant in the barracks?
Didn't she, is she the one who brings dinner rolls to the dinner party with Ben that actually ends up being a date when she goes, I brought dinner, I hope you like dinner rolls, and then Ben goes, I do indeed, which will be a sound that we hear at some point in season four on the podcast.
I say so. Also, such a weird line to say, I brought dinner rolls.
Yeah, but the even weirder when he looks and he goes, I do indeed, Ben is so strange. Such a strange guy.
But yeah, so I imagine that Juliet is the gourmand here. We wondered who replaced Hurley as the chef, and I think it was Juliet.
All right, so I like that. I like that fan fiction. A point for Juliet this week for sure for the burger craftsmanship. Ben comes in, and this is where he's like, all right, got to talk to Jack. And Jack's like, anything you say in front of me, I'm comfortable with Juliet being here, and I'm thrilled that you're fine with her being here, but this is doctor patient stuff. Mm-hmm. I've got a thing that I want to talk to you about. This is a private matter. So Juliet leaves. And this is where Ben's like, we had such a good plan to break you. I don't know that you lead with that.
Yeah. And also, I don't know how wonderful the plan was, particularly considering that, I don't know, if your entire plan hinges on Jack not seeing your x-rays, then like, it wasn't a very well-crafted plan.
You know, a lot of the time, so Ben ultimately is going to deliver a plan that, you know, he's not the full engineer of it, but he is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back on Jack's "We Have to Go Back." He's going to kill Locke, and that's what pushes Jack over the edge. So ultimately, Ben will engineer a plan, a wonderful plan that breaks Jack and gets him back in the mode of like, let's get the band back together and let's go back to the island. But I think oftentimes when Ben employs the "let me shoot straight with you" strategy to Jack, I don't think it really works so well. Like, he's trying to tell him here, right? Like, he's telling you exactly, like, this is what the plan was. I want you to want to save my life. And like, I was going to con you and blah, blah, blah. And Jack is like going to ultimately go ahead and do this, but only when he sees like an opportunity to make the plan his own. Then towards the end of the season, when we get, you know, what will be a contender for the biggest Ben beatdowns of the whole series.
Oh, yeah.
When Jack just like kicks the snot out of him, like kicks his teeth in. It's going to be after Ben's like, let's sit down and just like talk straight up. And like, that doesn't go well either. So Ben's whole thing here where he comes to Jack to talk, like, didn't you notice that Juliet looks like Sarah? Like, that doesn't land well with Jack. So this tact that he takes with Jack, for somebody who's spent a decent amount of time with the good doctor, I still don't think that he really gets Jack very well quite yet.
Yeah, well, I think for Ben at this point, he is trying to make Jack see them as like, let's talk leader to leader. You know, you're the leader of 815. I'm the leader of the others. Look, I understand how tough it is. Mondays, right? Like, he is trying to, I think, see that personal association with him. And while that worked on someone like John Locke, who I think has a similar devotion to the island, like you said, as much as Jack appreciates honesty, I think at this point, like, any bridge has been burnt. Perhaps by the smoke monster, ironically enough. Because Jack's like, I don't care if you're telling the truth to me or not. You know, you got Michael to kill people. You took his son. You kidnapped a bunch of us. Like, I'm not going to play buddy-buddy with you. And so, like, I don't even think once Jack sort of gets more entrenched into New Otherton, if he and Ben still even have a working relationship. And so I totally agree that I think the tack that Ben is taking, he's able to work with much more pliable forces like Locke or, hell, even Sawyer. Last episode, he gets one over extremely on Sawyer at the end of Every Man for Himself. But Jack is just someone who, at this point, already has a certain opinion of Ben that is not going to be warped by anything that Ben says, whether he's telling the truth or not. Because Jack already has this all figured out. So why does he feel like he needs to listen to him?
All right. So before Ben leaves, he is going to posit a question to Jack. I'd like to listen in on that. Sound number 3.
Do you believe in God, Jack?
Do you?
2 days after I found out I had a fatal tumor on my spine, a spinal surgeon fell out of the sky. And if that's not proof of God, I don't know what is.
And that's Lost, right?
Yeah, I mean, let me bring in some Jim Fell stuff here, not just to go too much to the end, but this scene brings up a very rarely used Ben motif, but I think that from a musical perspective, the Ben motif features a lot of, like, harp and violin that really, especially in season 3, like, tremolos to signal uncertainty and just general disquietness. But this scene brings in some piano, as you hear, which Jim speculates possibly means that Ben, at this moment in those particular set of lines, is speaking from the heart, that this is not the con that this man has been spinning, you know, since we found him in the middle of season 2, that he does legitimately think about this divine providence, which I would agree with. I think you just replaced the word God with Jacob, and I think this totally scans with Ben's character.
Yeah, I think so too. Like, I do think that Ben, I do think that Ben believes, and like the big thing with Ben is he himself is believing in something and following something so fervently, and yet is constantly denied access to the undeniable proof. And that's what makes faith such a difficult prospect for him ultimately. He is like I have every reason to believe. I really want to believe. Look how hard I'm believing. Why don't you believe in me? Like, do you believe in God is a great question coming from Ben, because I think Ben's probably bigger question would be for God, and do you believe in me would be the question. You know, and that is what he asks Jacob before he kills him. What about me? What about you? He interprets that poorly, praising Jacob. You know, maybe you could have delivered that better.
This has been an all-time slam podcast on Jacob so far.
Jacob, you know, really a lot of swings and misses from Jacob. But I just think that that's it's a great scene. It's a great encapsulation of Lost, is this idea of all of these people. Don't mistake coincidence for fate, but as you point out as well. Such a very, very, very Ben Linus-y scene.
And also a call from Ben as well to, again, this is not going to necessarily fall on deaf ears, but not maybe work on Jack as well as he thought, but he's now making a plea to Jack of like, you were meant to do this.
Yeah.
Basically, I know he was intending for the onus to be put on Ben of, oh, this opportunity fell into my lap. This means that there are powers above. But I feel like it has to be surreptitiously hinting to Jack too, right? Like, oh, you're the special person that was brought here to do this specifically for me. Turns out not to be the case whatsoever. But you can imagine that, again, to your point, Ben being such a devout person to Jacob would also try to use as an opportunity for manipulation, even if it doesn't exactly pan out.
But also wondering, like, well, I have been in such great service of Jacob. Was this for me? Is this a gift? Is this a sign from God that he exists? Is this something that he has dropped specifically for me? You know, I think the me of it all for Ben, to bring
such a good singing voice,
the G.I. Joe Fensler films of it all. All right. So Echo and Locke, they're walking through the jungle. Locke asks Echo, why are you looking for Yemi? Echo doesn't like that Locke said Yemi.
Yeah. This is so interesting because this is such a far cry from the calm Mr. Echo that we see throughout season two. And I think maybe this shows to your point that like Echo is just on his last legs. He is at the end of his rope, or it could mean that he's so emotionally wound up at this point that he would go aggro on someone like Locke. This is sort of like the old Echo peeking through a bit, where usually he is much more taking the devout path of serenity. This is a bit of, I think, Warlord Echo peeking through, of holding a knife to Locke's throat saying, don't ever say my brother's name again.
Yeah, part of me recognizes in Echo in this episode, a guy who like recognizes that this is like the final hour of my life.
Mm.
You know, like I feel like he is like on edge in that way of like, time is running out for me and I don't have a lot of time to sort my affairs. Like that's how I don't know. It's just how the character kind of reads to me. And I don't know how much that is like, what's like sort of intentional in the performance versus just like what I'm reading into it. But that's a way of looking at the episode of like, Echo is so on edge because he knows that what's going on with Yemi is messed up. And he knows that he is on his way towards, you know, it's time to confess, like, is such like a punctuated, pointed destination that it feels like a final destination.
Or it could be a performance note from AAA, knowing this is going to be his last episode of like, I want to show the highs and lows of this character from an emotional perspective. If I'm going to go out, let me go out by showing my greatest hits in a manner of speaking.
Yeah. Maybe final destination also why he ultimately dies. He's supposed to die in the hatch.
I think that makes sense.
Polar bears.
I mean, in that perspective, they could have made things a lot more creative, like those final destination. I want to see Echo get sucked to the bottom of a pool filter LASIK.
No. Oh, no. Terrible, terrible, terrible. All right. Flashback. What's there to say? Echo knows that he gets all the details about the vaccine. He's going to sell the vaccine.
He's got a cool hat on. That's what I made him note of.
Yeah, he looks great. He's going to sell the vaccine to make some quick cash on his way out of the country. And I think that this is just helping to inform this idea of who is Mr. Echo in the immediate aftermath of losing the thing that matters to him most. I think that that's a worthy meditation for this character on his way out the door.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it goes back to him getting onto the way we see him in season two was not a light switch. It was a dial. And I think much more effectively than question mark, this flashback does show that it was not an immediate switch, that he is someone who's like, oh crap, this thing is going on. Well, I'm going to get the hell out of Dodge, as opposed to when he, you know, actually helping the community. And even when he does, it's not going to be in the most devout way.
No, not at all. So everybody gets to the Pearl Station. Mr. Echo kind of goes off on his own and was like, what's he doing? And Nikki's like, oh, he's looking for his brother's body. It's in the plane. It's like, shut up, Nikki. Why are you talking right now? You are just lucky to be here on the trip.
Now it made me realize, like, did they all know about? I mean, obviously, Nick and Paolo knew about the Pearl. But when Locke's like, hey, we're all going to the Pearl, I guess that was common knowledge, because then nobody's like, oh, wow, what the hell is this place? I've never heard of this before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, a bunch of chatty Cathys among the gawkers from whom Nikki and Paolo stem. So it makes sense that they would know all the hot goss as it pertains to Mr. Echo. But they're going to go down the hatch, much like we do every week. To check out what's down in the Pearl Station. But Locke is going to take a time out from his mission to the hatch. He can walk and chew gum. He's just thankful to walk. And
he's been chewing gum for a few years.
Yeah. It's time to kick ass and chew bubble gum, and I'm all out of kicking. So he's going to talk to Echo and help Echo out, as Echo is going to search the plane looking for Yemi. And Locke maybe intuits that this is the moment, because he knows that Echo saw the thing, right? Like, right. He understands that Echo saw the monster, which maybe is not a monster to John. And he wants to know what Echo saw. So this is a conversation that I think gets thought about a lot when it comes to Lost.
So, what exactly did you see back there? Yeah, I saw it once, you know.
And what did you see?
I saw a very bright light. It was beautiful.
That is not what I saw.
Yeah. So we wonder, right? Like, did Locke see the monster? Mm-hmm. Did Locke see... Does Jacob have a monster form and it's a white light? We'll never know. We'll never get that reverse
angle. Or was it just
angle.
Desmond going to the bathroom?
Mm-hmm. Or was it just Desmond going to the bathroom?
Well, yeah, so we'll talk about going to the bathroom later. It's interesting, though, because let's also remember the last time that Locke saw the monster, as much as he talked here and as very early on as White Rabbit about, like, I looked into the island and what I saw was beautiful. The last time he saw the monster, the monster was going to drag him into a hole, and Locke looked very scared. So I do think it's interesting how, you know, maybe Locke is probing Echo a bit to also find out what he saw, because maybe the smoke monster sort of sending him mixed signals at this point as to what it truly intends. I also think, you know, some fun Jesus symbology here in the giant boulder in front of the plane. It's been obviously more than 3 days, but Echo rolls it away, and lo and behold, the body's not there. Stop me if you've heard that one before, Josh.
I've heard tell of this tale. My question is, when John saw the smoke monster for the first time, is what he saw, like, because we know the smoke monster can take on the form of corpses, did he take on the form of, like, a bunch of Dharma workers who had, like, flashlight helmets on? And so, like, there was just, like, a bunch of flashlight helmets on. So Locke just saw, like, a big conglomerate of bodies with a flashlight helmet on. So that was the bright light. And it was, when it all combined together, it was really pretty to look at.
Or it could be that, you know, a bunch of Dharma workers happened to get gas during 70s disco night, and they happen to, like, produce the ghost mirror ball along with the rest of these disco Dharma workers. Mm-hmm. And Locke saw the bright light coming from the disco ball and thought it was beautiful. He could be a big disco fan. I know he loves Geronimo Jackson. Maybe some disco is part of that as well.
Yeah, I think that would be good. I would love to see the Locke disco flashback, I feel like would be...
Oh my
Something
God.
We've been robbed
Terry
of.
O'Quinn with an afro wig.
Yeah, I just think, like, him doing the John Travolta walk would be really
Yeah, but
really
knowing
good.
John Locke, he would then, like, trip over a kid and, like, fall into a manhole or something.
John Travolta. All right, let's so Yemi's gone. Where's my brother? My brother is gone. Locke says, well, maybe he burnt. Maybe the animals got him. Echo doesn't really want to entertain any of that. He's also not going to go down into the Pearl. He is instead going to stare at the photo of himself and his brother. He's also going to receive a final gift from John Locke. It's the cross, that he wears around his neck that Locke found in the jungle.
Yeah, which I think also feels, you know, pretty symbolic as well, even though Locke has sort of taken on all the characteristics of Echo. He is giving this back to him. And if indeed what you're saying is scans about him, this sort of being Echo's long walk to his execution, this is sort of like, they say you can't take it with you, but in this case, Echo isn't that he's receiving all right. of his possessions back before he goes.
Flashback time, Mr. Echo just like destroys Amika and all of Amika's dudes. Amika shows up. So you're going to sell the vaccine. I know that. You don't know who I am. You clearly don't know who I am. I'm not going to kill you because you're a holy dude. And that's, you know, I don't want to curse myself, but I am going to cut your hands off. And so they bind his hands. And Mr. Echo's like, I could do this with my hands tied behind my back, let alone in front of me. He knocks some dude in the face. Amika's knife gets buried in the podium. And Echo takes it and slices, you know, he montons one guy. Mm-hmm. He holds it up over Amika. Amika's begging for his life. And Mr. Echo says, you do not know who I am, before he brings it down.
Yep. And then he walks out of the church and he is covered in blood.
He also, for some reason, comes out of the church with both the machete and a handgun in his hand. It's like, why did he need to do it like that?
Maybe
it's
he
cool
thought
the,
that there
cool
were
for the poster, I guess.
Yeah, maybe he thought there were more of Amika's men out there just in
okay.
case.
But yeah, good.
Probably
good.
Worst image to walk out to, right? It's like, hey, I'm the priest. There's a bunch of bodies behind me. I'm slathered in blood and I'm holding two weapons. Who wants to come in and eat some wafers?
Do you think who is Mr. Echo in this moment? Is this just Warlord Echo? Or is this like more purely who he is, some sort of integration of like, you guys represent some of the struggle that my brother went through. Mm. And I am defending my brother's honor in his way in killing these people. Like, does he view what he's doing in this moment as yet another act of protection for Yami?
See, I'd like to believe so, because I feel like this scene connects directly to the other 48 days when Echo pretty ruthlessly kills those two others. And that's also what sort of sets off the others as well, of like, okay, listen, you could have kidnapped us, but you choose to kill two of us. That's really going to get us riled up. As I think even at this point, while Echo's still going through his transition, he thinks, you know what? I'm going to do whatever it takes at all costs. What I think, I'm fine. You know, the ends justify the means from Mr. Echo's perspective of, look, I prefer not to have this resort to violence, but you know what? If this is what it's going to have to come down to, then I'm prepared for it. I am not the meek, mild-mannered Yemi. I wonder if he almost feels a bit of judgment in Yemi, because, you know, this woman keeps coming up to me like, oh, well, Father Yemi brokered this deal
right.
to get the vaccines. Father Yemi did this. And I wonder if Echo, even though he does feel guilt around his brother's death, which leads him down the path in the present timeline, he maybe feels a bit like, well, Yemi got them into this situation and he's going to get them out of it. I do think, and this is going to connect to his quote unquote confession at the end of this episode, that I think Mr. Echo has a unique form of problem solving. And that as much as he might get sort of pushed down the path of moral absolutes, he himself does not believe in absolutes. And so I think that while this still is a transitional moment, I think it does plant a lot of seeds for stuff that we see Mr. Echo do on the island, which, while faith-based, still could cross that line morally as to whether or not it's right to do.
Yeah, and I think that there's an interesting thing to examine in, Yemi wasn't willing to, like, compromise for Echo, but apparently he was willing to compromise for other people.
Right.
Like there was this way where Echo views his life as a compromise for his brother's safety,
which Jacob Man in Black again.
Yeah, like he views his life as a compromise for his brother's safety, and maybe sees like in Yemi, like this man was also willing to compromise, but wouldn't compromise with Echo directly. Like wouldn't have any more of Echo's blood on his hands, would not put himself in a place that corrupted Echo any further. So in a way, almost like in Yemi's way, recognizing a way in which Yemi tried to protect Echo, tried to save his soul, tried to protect his soul. So I think like there could be in this moment, like some processing of that, of either like some guilt that's tied up in that, or some anger that's tied up in that, or some love that's tied up in that. a lot. I sibling relationships are so complex.
Very much. So.
You know, very, 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 very.
As one host once said once upon a time, the interesting thing about being siblings is that none of you are the father or the mother.
Yeah, you know, and it's true. That is a true statement. And there's just a lot there. And so I think this being one of the show's foremost explorations of that, short of Jacob and the Man in Black, just makes this, I think this is a very rich and rewarding text, this episode.
Yeah, and I think also, like you said, the sibling dynamic is something we haven't seen since Boone and Shannon, if that even counts. And
right.
That obviously has its own sort of circumstances that surround it and make it very different. And you could say that, like, there are certainly brothers in faith. There are certainly brothers from a belief system.
Right. And technically, everybody is Desmond's brother.
Exactly. So, like, that could be the thing. But when it comes to, like, blood, you know, the blood that courses through the veins that connect Yemi and Echo versus the blood that spatters Echo as he walks out of the church, it's a very interesting distinction. But so I personally read the scene as like a bit of an Echo being like trigger happy, him reverting back to Warlord Echo for a second of like, okay, how would I ordinarily solve this problem if I was still my Warlord self? But I think part of it is also maybe him setting his own code up in a manner of speaking of it's going to result and things end up being worse for the village because they still have a Warlord problem and now they have no church. But at the same time, Echo is now sort of set up how he is going to personify this role moving forward is, you know, let me walk the path of the Lord. But if something gets in my way, I'm not afraid to shoot at it or chop it up.
Yeah. And think about other sibling relationships on the show. Such, you know, great opportunity with Jack and Claire stuff that I don't think that they really capitalize on.
Yeah, I agree.
It's like, it's more just like, well, that's a cool connection. But I don't know. We'll talk about that stuff more. We'll have opportunities for that. A couple weeks from now. All right. So everyone's dead. All of them are dead. Back on the island. Dr. Mark Wickman, everybody, is just hanging out. He's got two arms right now. And Nikki is just like, she's in the chair. She's glued to the TV.
And Locke is so, you think Locke's like really embarrassed right now, right? Because he's like, oh, this is the movie that had me going haywire for a couple days.
Maybe to a certain degree. I like how Nikki is like, what about the other TVs? We want to turn one of them on? Maybe there's a certain show that's on that we could watch. I don't know if any of you have noticed me, recognized me from anything.
Do you think she would want that, though? Do you think she would want to be recognized?
Yeah, why not? You know, it gives her a little more power on the island. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, maybe at this point, I think if she was still, like, searching for those diamonds, she would want the less attention on her, the better. But I wonder if this point now she's bored enough that she's going full Charlie and is like, oh, have you heard of me with expose? Razzle-dazzle,
yeah.
Anyone?
Yeah, razzle-dazzle. So that's what Nikki is doing. What's Paolo up to?
Your tour of duty in the world will last 3 weeks.
No, toilet still works.
This, so I was on the Storm podcast with Joanna Robinson a couple weeks ago for Exposé, and we were talking about how, like, this scene around the internet, I believe it labeled Paolo as takes a shit guy. there's no recovering from this.
No.
This is a character who is having his biggest introduction, basically. You know, he's been introduced. He was in Every Man for Himself. But here he is, part of, like, the A squad looking for Mr. Echo and looking for the Pearl. This rando from nowhere with no explanation. And in the middle of everybody trying to figure out what to do about, like, how to contact the others and everything, he's just apparently taken a tour of duty, as Dr. Wickman would describe it. So, yeah, I believe he became known as Takes a Shit Guy. There was just no way to ever come back from that for Nikki and Paolo. And Nikki, I think, got some spray from that as well.
Oh, ew. I mean, yeah, there's, and especially, again, talking about the characterization between, like, him having sex in Jack's tent and him complaining to Desmond last episode about how, you know, everyone else goes out into the jungle and they don't include him. And then now him saying, like, hey, I poo-pooed in the Pearl. It's just not, it's really over three in terms of the introduction. Like, Nikki's fine, I suppose, here. She's the one that points out wisely, like, oh, wait, there's a chance that there could be more hatches here. I'm finally catching on to what these two other guys didn't the last time we were here. But yeah, Paolo is superfluous to this episode completely.
Yeah. Yeah. Takes a shit guy, everybody. So Saeed is going to figure out how to reroute the TVs to look in on the TVs of the other stations, because Saeed's a genius and he does this in like 5 seconds. And picture comes up and there's another station and Paolo goes, "Hey, look, computers. Cool. Shut up, Paolo. Here's Mikhail. First sighting of Mikhail with his eye patch, and this lit everybody up. Flame station, yep. Pun unintended. And everyone's like, oh, who's the eye patch guy? Who's the eye patch guy? We'd have to wait a little bit longer to find out in greater detail who the eye patch guy is. One thing that I noted this time, Mike, that I had never noted before is this is our first introduction to the guy who's going to basically kill Charlie, right?
Mm-hmm.
He puts his hand up to the camera. Kind of like a cool contrast to the Not Penny's book.
Yeah, that's a great call that we forget that as many times as Mikhail dies, his final sort of streak, if you believe that, again, we'll move forward with my personal...
Careful with the streaks.
But my personal theory is that Mikhail died with the sonar fence and that every time we see him afterwards, it is the smoke monster. But the last time we see, apparently, Mikhail is him, blowing up the window into the looking glass. But that's a great call forward. And Locke, again, just like... really, basically like tripping on E this entire episode, smiles and says, oh, I guess he'll be expecting us. So I'm not sure what Locke has in mind, but he is very happy to meet Mikhail, apparently.
Yeah, Locke is having a great time here. So yeah, introduction to Mikhail. We're going to have a lot to talk about with Mikhail in the weeks ahead. I do just remember being like, ooh, eye patch man, that's cool.
Yeah, well, especially because he was wearing a Dharma uniform as well, mm-hmm. which, you know, we hadn't seen since the end of Live Together, Die Alone, and we had assumed that all the other, since the only other one we really knew about, we knew the Pearl and we knew the Arrow, both of which had been vacant. We thought like, okay, all these other blast maps, the blast map stations are apparently vacant as well. Apparently not. Seems the flame is at least populated by one person and many cows minus one that went to Juliet.
And he's on screen long enough, and I don't know if he's in the guest cast list, but certainly people were able to connect that this is Andrew Divoff, who is a horror icon, or at least icon adjacent, as the Wishmaster. And I don't remember which Wishmaster movie this is in, but there's, you know, his character, the Wishmaster, grants you wishes, and it's never what you want. You usually die because of it. And there's one movie where he's in jail. I remember watching it with my brother when I was a kid, and mm-hmm. I don't remember, like, the context. I think it's like, he's trying to like recruit somebody to his cause, or he's just doing like one of his evil wishmastery things about trying to kill somebody. But like, he's asking this other guy in prison, he goes, what is it you want? Money? Power? Sex? And that line has always been what I've associated with Mikhail Bakunin as a result.
Interesting. So maybe he could have done some better bargaining with 815 once they come into contact with him and take him.
Money? Power? Six. Okay, so that's Mikhail. Let's go back to Hydra Island. What's going to happen here is a scene that, if this was not the cost of living and the Mr. Echo deathisode, I think that this episode could have been called Lost Actually, as we are going to have Juliet.
And Rodrigo Santoro would be in it mm-hmm, as well.
Indeed. And Juliet is going to come to Jack with a television. She says, I wanted you to watch a movie, and I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about the thing with Ben. And what you are going to hear, the exact opposite of everything that Juliet is saying, is what's actually happening on television.
You don't trust me anymore?
I trust you just fine. Just thought I'd put a movie in.
You know what? I'm going to pass on the movie.
You'll like this one, Jack. To Kill a Mockingbird. It's a classic.
Juliet, I don't want to watch a movie
right
now.
I'll turn the sound down then. I felt like I should apologize. Say I'm sorry. I'm sorry for bringing you here. And for everything that's been done to you and your friends. You have to know, we were desperate. It was all so we could save his life. Ben. He's a great man. I know you find that hard to believe, but he is. You probably feel like you don't have a choice, but you do, Jack. Free will is all we've really got, right?
Juliet.
two cents. I told you before, you can trust me. I want you to trust me now when I tell you that doing the surgery is absolutely the right thing for you to do. It's the right thing because he deserves to live.
Turn the movie off.
Jack.
Turn it off. Now.
All right, it's off. Think about what I said. Please.
One of the best scenes of the season so far, for sure.
Oh, and
an all-timer.
I'll go as far as to say that's the best Hydra Island scene we ever get.
It's up there. Yeah, I think it's a real contender for sure. I love Jack on the radio with Kate next week, but this is just really creative.
Yeah.
Really great performance from Elizabeth Mitchell, from Matthew Fox as well.
Oh, yeah. He really sells the turn the movie off when, you know, he's supposed to come across as like very withered. And obviously, when Juliet comes in, the chumminess is out the window. They're no longer bantering about burgers. Jack is now fuming after what Ben told him, that now he's sort of like forsworn Juliet. And,
yeah.
But Juliet says, forsooth. And she says, here, watch this. And despite now knowing that there's a chance he might have someone on the inside wanting to work with him, he does a good job of being the con man, in a manner of speaking, and trying to come across like he's still in that mood as when she came in.
Well, I think that he, yeah, and one thing that I noticed on this watch that I hadn't seen before was when Juliet says, think about what I said as she leaves. Jack gives like a very earnest nod back.
Yeah.
You know, and of course he's not going to, you know, he's not going to do the plan. Like, he has his own plan that he's going to come up with. But I think in this moment, at least, he's considering it for real.
Yeah. And I mean, I love this scene so much because first.
So great. It's so great. Everybody loves Ben. Translation. Everybody hates Ben. Ben should totally live. Translation. Ben should totally die. Everybody thinks that Ben is a really good person who definitely deserves to live and you should do the surgery. Translation. Everybody thinks Ben's a big piece of poo-poo and yep. think that you should sever his spine and kill him in the surgery and it'll be an accident. You should do that.
Well, even to the point where it's like, free will is all we've got, right? And the cards say like, oh, well, we hate Ben because Ben makes us feel small.
Yeah.
It's so great. And I love what it represents too. Like, obviously now we have the hindsight as to what Juliet has been undergoing. You talked about the dinner roles of it all, but really outside of a couple of choice scenes, this is the first time that we see Juliet's true feelings about Ben and the position she's in. And the cracks were starting to show a bit with the picket of it all, you know, the past few episodes, but this is really the first time that we see a major crack here, some insubordination. And it is so fantastically done. I love the theming of double talk as well. The irony that Ben tries to be as quote-unquote truthful as he is to Jack in this episode, but Juliet is the one to win him over by precisely doing double talk and appeasing the cameras and being truthful with Jack. There's even though, you know, as much as you might talk about the oppositional talk, there is still meaning in what Juliet is talking if you ascribe to it the meaning from the cards, like when she says, that's up to you, Jack, or when she says, I want you to trust me now when I say that surgery is absolutely the right thing to do. From her perspective, she's not wrong with that. I will dock her a small point for maybe not the best use of the cards. Like, I don't think Ben is a liar had to fit onto one card entirely. You could have fit a couple of other sentences on there. The jungle's not lacking for trees, but I have to imagine how many died in order for Juliet to be able to make these cards happen.
Yeah, how many slices of Michael had to be taken in order to create this poster board. It's just a great scene. And this is like very clearly like Juliet shooting her shot.
Yeah.
You know?
And there's incredible cinematography here as well. where the last shots in this scene, Ben, well, actually, so Ben, before when he talks to Jack, the lighting in the fish tank is very Two-Face in a manner speaking, where one of Ben's, I think his left side is shrouded in darkness and his right side is lit up, which sort of symbolizes, again, the Two-Faced aspect of it. And that final shot, as you mentioned, when Jack and Julia look at one another, they're both sort of like shrouded in blue light.
Yeah.
To really add some like ambiance and a real tone to the scene. And that's how we leave off of Hydra Island. That's how we end this episode. And it's such a great point to leave things off of, because now it leaves things really up in the air, where Jack knows, you know, what he has to do. But now, you know, he might not be stuck here forever because there might be someone that's willing to help him.
So that's the end of the Hydra Island stuff. And the rest of the episode is the Echo send-off. And it begins with the flashback where, you know, Echo is packing up to leave and the church is now being boarded up and closed because Echo defiled it, basically. It's no longer sacred.
Happen when you kill a few people in it.
Yeah, the woman that he's been speaking with throughout the episode tells him, like, those men you killed are going to be replaced by other men, and one day you'll be judged for what you did. You should start making your peace now. And if you really believe that this is Yami's church, you owe him a church.
Yeah.
And I guess that explains why he's building a Starbucks, I mean a church, on the island.
I also love that Daniel asks him, are you a bad man? Because I definitely heard it initially as, are you Batman? Which, I mean, Batman has also made some very morally ambiguous choices, so it's not too far off.
Adewale would be a badass Batman. That'd be super cool.
I would love that, but only as Mr. Echo, as Batman.
I believe he ended up being Killer Croc.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. So,
Batman, I think he needs another Batman try adjacent. At a DC character.
Batman adjacent. Yeah, so that's what's going on there. And I think, like, again, like the punctuation of, like, not just like Yemi dying in his hands, but like how he bungled Yemi's legacy on his way out the door.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that that's instructive. I do think that that helps inform the character a little bit more as we start to lose him, as we begin the process of leaving Mr. Echo. I think this flashback does have utility, and I think it's got some great scenes in it. I have basically zero issue with the flashback.
This poor village. I feel so bad now.
It's been through a lot.
I guess they're swimming in vaccines, but now they're going to have a world problem, and now they have no church to absolve for their sins.
So it's tough. It's tough. Very, very bad. All right. So back on the island, as Echo is sort of just chilling by the plane, here he comes, Mr. Smoke Show. We heard this at the top of the podcast. Yemi is going to lure Echo out into the middle of this field filled with flowers that I do not believe we ever see again on the show.
I don't think so, which is fine, because again, if you want to leave it for like a special moment, but God.
Yes, this is a great one.
Flora is gorgeous. And maybe it's because we're not used to seeing Flora, sans the orchid, quite literally, on Lost, that it's almost like the poppies from The Wizard of Oz, which again brings up this idea of like, oh, is it all hallucinatory?
Yeah, for sure. Getting very sleepy. All right. Well, here it is for the second time on Down the Hatch. We're going to listen to, we heard this once upon a time, once upon a while in a previous Echo episode. We brought this in early. We're going to bring it in again because it's important. It's Echo's final confession. Listen it.
I ask for no forgiveness, Father, for I have not sinned. I have only done what I needed to do to survive. A small boy once asked me if I was a bad man. If I could answer him now, I would tell him that when I was a young boy, I killed a man to save my brother's life. I am not sorry for this. I am proud of this. I did not ask for the life that I was given, but it was given nonetheless. And with it, I did my best. You speak to me as if I were your brother.
a long time ago, a small boy asked me if I was Batman. I should have said yes. Is there anything that you want to add to the conversation around Echo's confession at this point, Mike?
So I know that that last episodic podcast, we talked about my favorite line of Lost, Dear Goo Goo Gaga. Mm-hmm. But I will say one line that has also really stuck with me for very different reasons is, I did not ask for the life I was given, but it was given nonetheless. And with it, I did my best. Because, I mean, you talk about emblematic phrases of Lost. And this, I feel like, is one that is not talked about a lot. But man, does it speak volumes to not only the show, but to life. Especially nowadays, with how many circumstances in the world get thrown at us each and every day. And how we almost need to forgive ourselves for the decisions we make and the reasons that we do things just because of the circumstances around us. I know I've certainly reckoned with that as well. And this scene, I don't know, I viewed this scene differently the first time than when I viewed it now. And it's weird to say, but I think a little bit is couched in my own sense of self-forgiveness. Like, the first time I saw this, I'm like, no, Echo did some really bad shit. Why does he not, you know, confess about it? But to see Echo's final stand here, the reason why I love it so, so much is because Echo affirms here he is a man who is going to die on his feet and live on his knees. He is somebody who is going to say, I have been through a journey. I have straddled both sides of morality and tried to figure out exactly what the right thing to do is. And I have realized that I have made no mistakes in the path that I've explored. I have certainly done bad things, but those were rational. Those were out of necessity. Now, granted, you might say from an objective perspective, that might not be the case, but to give that perspective to Echo, it's such an amazing confession. Again, not really a confession because he said he has nothing to confess, but it's an amazing statement to me because it shows that, again, when they're are these themes of absolutes in Lost, man of science, man of faith, one player is white, one player is black, you know, even the brothers of Jacob and the man in black to represent that. Here is a character who will outright say, actually, it's somewhere in the middle. And I am more than happy to live in the middle. It's such a new statement about the show that we really don't experience from many characters, especially when things do become a bit more good versus evil. Even as you know, recent as this season with the induction of the others and sort of what Ben is doing. So for Echo's final moment, for him to essentially realize, I am comfortable with what I did to the point where I have journeyed all this way to seek forgiveness and confess to my brother, and I realize I don't need to. It is incredibly, incredibly powerful. And that's what I say at the very beginning of this podcast, that I think Echo, from a psychological perspective, goes out on a high note because he has affirmed to himself that the ends did justify the means.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we talk about how the show's argument is not like the answer to the man of science versus man of faith debate is supposed to be a little column A, a little column B. So you're talking about like that balance that Echo is striking here. Like he's reached the resolution that you're supposed to reach by the end of the show, right? Like that is where he's at in this moment. He's somebody who both believes in this higher power, but also believes in the practicality of working within the circumstances that you are given.
Right.
And knowing that he can't be forgiven for some of his things. But also knowing that that's not something he needs either, that is not something he needs from something else. He needs to be able to forgive himself. And Mike, I'm really happy to hear that you in this time have found self-forgiveness because I have not forgiven you for Count Jakula.
No, I don't think he can forgive you for the Count Jakulum that you brought up before.
Yeah, gross.
But
still
that's
on
the thing
floor.
As well.
It's on the floor.
But that's an interesting point, though, is I think what Echo is saying is ascribed to a lot of people. Sawyer is in this weird cyclical thing where he was had a life foisted upon him, but he makes purposely self-destructive choices to keep in that vicious cycle. John Locke is someone who has had a lot of circumstances fall into his lap and has changed as a result. A lot of these characters, like you said, given where they were in their lives, can certainly agree with this statement of, I did not ask for the the life.
I didn't ask for this. This is what I was given, and I'm doing my best.
Yeah.
It is all anyone can do, is to do your level best. Like, you know, maybe Echo shouldn't have done all of the things that he did, but maybe he didn't have the luxury of making some of these choices, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, the line, "You speak to me as if I'm your brother," super chilling.
So chilling.
Such Bone a great chilling. Turn as well, because again, as weird as Yemi was this entire episode, like, I think he was still, like, a welcoming force. You know, as we've talked about in the previous two Echo episodes, this was a Yemi who guided him to the Pearl, guided him to the Beechcraft. Like, this was supposed to be a welcome spirit guide in Echo's life, and that the turn here is so...
It's such a betrayal. But it's this double betrayal in this interpretation of the Man in Black being so bitterly disappointed in Echo's answer, right? Of like, oh, so you're not going to be my guy. You're not going to bend to me. You're not going to bend the knee. I'm going to have to kill you now. We don't relate on this level. You're not going to be my disciple. I think this is something that is brutally disappointing to the Man in Black, and is a huge piece of why the very next scene we get is the death, right? It's the beatdown of Echo just getting wrecked by the Man in Black, by the smoke monster. It's so horrible to watch. It was just really tough to watch this time.
No, I mean, it's brutal, because again, we hadn't seen the monster kill anybody since Seth Norris. We've certainly seen, you know, brutal deaths, but nothing like, and even Seth Norris got killed off camera and then dropped bloodily into trees. Echo, we see every ounce of him getting thrown around. I will also recommend, if people want to search out the Lost on Location for this episode, which we'll probably put in the show notes, does a great job of really showing how this scene comes to life between the wire work and making the smoke monster come to life. It's a really cool thing if you're interested in behind the scenes stuff. But yeah, I mean, this is brutal. They are tearing this character apart. Another reason why I also like the "you speak to me as if I'm your brother" is because, again, if we're connecting this to the Man in Black's personal struggle,
exactly,
he sees like, oh, I thought you were like me, but you're like Jacob. You speak to me as if I am your brother. You speak to me as if you
were not
my brother.
Brothers in this, like, as if like this could have been a brother of his own. You know, one of the things as well is I often have assigned what happens with Mr. Echo, what happens with John Locke, as being like picking up all of like the Mr. Echo story energy. But Damon Lindelof does state that a lot of what happens in the stories with Desmond and Ben moving forward are retrofitted pieces of what was going to happen with Mr. Echo. That with Desmond, the psychic visions of the future and all of that stuff was going to be happening through Mr. Echo rather than through Desmond. But what's like the Ben stuff that was there through Mr. Echo? And like you can imagine that world in which if Mr. Echo chose the right cup to drink from here, if he chose wisely, right? That like he is not smashed into a tree. He's not killed here. But he is now a huge piece in the monster's plan to bring down Jacob, and Echo is occupying the Ben role where his faith is going to get him into a position where he gets Jacob killed and helps unlock the monster.
Yeah, Dom, I would definitely see a point where Echo basically take Ben from, you know, there's no place like home moving forward, and replace him with Echo, and I could very much see a very similar path.
Yeah, so I think that is very there.
Including and like killing Locke. If you know, we talk about the Locke-Ben relationship, but I could also see a world
Echo
where
kills
Echo kills Locke, because that's
sure.
a very entrenched 100%. Relationship as well.
100%, that like Echo starts seeing visions of a future, and he's like, okay, this is the way it has to go. And he's having like a lot of faith in the visions that he's seeing, but the visions are bad, right? Like he's seeing something that the monster wants him to see.
Yeah, and he could have a connection with Charlie too, considering that he had that in season two with him.
You know, there's a lot of ways in which you can imagine how like the Desmond and Ben storylines could have been folded through Echo, and they are like very scary to consider. And I actually do think what we get with Echo is a much happier ending for the character in the long run. I just do think it's so interesting. "You speak to me as if I'm your brother" does have this other meaning once you know who the Man in Black is, and that interpretation of like, we were going to be brothers in this, like you were going to be my guy. You were going to come off
the chosen one.
Yeah. You know, the way that like he looks at Claire later on is like, you know, almost in this like paternal way. So that's a really fascinating read. So he kills Mr. Echo. He bashes him around. The end of the episode has beautiful music and imagery. the imagery will be harder to hear. We'll talk about it, but let's just listen to the end of the episode.
Echo. It's okay. It's okay. What did he say, John?
He said, we're next.
No, he
said, you're next. He said, you're next. It's you. He said, you're next. For sure. You are all, every last one of you. You, Saeed, Desmond, Nikki, and Paolo will die next.
I hate that Nikki and Paolo are there for Echo's death. They don't deserve to be there.
They don't. Just pretend that they're not there. Just like George Lucas them out of your mind.
Yeah, couldn't you have just gone to the bathroom again, Paolo?
So there he goes.
There he goes again.
He is gone. Mr. Echo, an echo in the wind. Mike, can you pull in anything from the Jim Fells music analysis now? Is there anything from this that Jim weighed in on? I'd be really curious to hear.
Actually, there's not really. He does make mention of something completely different that maybe we'll get to at the end. But no, I mean, it's, you can hear it. It's sort of as a meditation on life and death. And I can imagine it mixes in some of the echo motifs from, you know, his previous two outings. But Jim, if there was anything I missed, or if you have any stuff in your miscellaneous notes about the Echo death scene, definitely let us know, because it's definitely a take on life and death, and I'm happy it's different than the outright life and death, because this feels different. Right?
Well, what it feels like to me, and the reason why I ask, and it's because this is again fanficky stuff, but this is how I have come to view the cost of living and how I've come to view the ending of Mr. Echo, is that sounds like the end of Lost. It's not the end of Lost. But it the feelings it evokes within me are the feelings that are evoked when Jack is dying and you are now aware of what happens when you die in this world. That whatever mattered most to you, whatever helped you become who you ended up as, that you find those people again, you find those circumstances again, you get to move on together again. So this brings us back to the first scene of the episode. And so the final thing that you're seeing in this is Mr. Echo is passing away. He whispers to John. You see this vision of him and Yemi walking together as boys. And we get this very, kind of like surreal look of them walking off into the sun. And the slow motion kicking back up again to a certain degree. There's like a surreality to it.
Yeah.
And I think you connect that back to the first scene of the episode of Echo and Yemi eating the crackers and Echo being told that this was a sin and that he must confess. That being such a specific underlined word throughout this episode, that I choose to read the ending of Mr. Echo as that first scene in this episode with him and Yemi as boys and him and Yemi getting to walk off away at the end as Echo's sideways.
Oh, interesting.
That's where Echo gets to go. That he and Yemi get to find each other. And I think especially when you think of where Echo landed, I guess literally, but where Echo emotionally landed at this place of, I don't need to apologize to my brother, but I do need to talk to my brother and help him understand who I am. Mm. It feels like there is, and I think in Yemi's final moments too, Yemi did that for his brother as well, right? Like, I'm coming to save you. I can't let you go like this. I have to save you. That this love for each other was so profound between these brothers. And you think about like things that were activation points in the sideways or ways in which like people's endings were reflected in their sideways existence, like Jack with the cut on his neck or the cut to his side that he gets from his final battle with the man in black. I just look at that word confess as such an underlined word in the final few minutes of Mr. Echo's life. And I just think it's a happier way to look at it. That like, and I think that there is this look of, I don't know, about contentment, maybe.
I think peace. It's probably peace. A good way to put it.
Peace. And I think like a potential like buster to this idea is, doesn't Hurley play chess with Mr. Echo at some point in the future of the show? And I would, so like there's a ghost of Mr. Echo somewhere around here. So how does he make it to his end of the Flash sideways? I would respond to that by saying there's a Charlie ghost and Charlie makes it through the church door. And also that Christian Shepherd explicitly says there is no now here. Right. So, you know, if you're going to subscribe to the belief that the people like the Whispers who don't move on, like Michael, never, ever, 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 ever move on, then that's a really bleak outlook for those people.
Yeah, once you died, you're there forever is rough.
As opposed to just like time does not apply to that next step that they get to, that final step that they get to take before they become whatever they become next. So for me, the power of the cost of living is not just in like how this advances smoke monster mythology through Mr. Echo, because I think it really does that beautifully. But I also think that the ending of Lost recontextualizes Echo's death for me and my stupid, over-obsessed, built a Lost to Animal Crossing Island obsessed brain with the show. That I view the cost of living and this final scene of Echo and Yemi walking off together as their version of going through that church door at the end of the whole show.
No, I had a very similar thought, that this felt to me like a representation of these two brothers seeing each other again in the afterlife. And then maybe that's sort of this piece with Echo as well when he dies, is like, I thought I was talking to my brother here. Clearly I was led astray, but now I finally get to. And now I know what I need to say to him. It's such an interesting way to end the character. Plus, I mean, you talk about connecting back to the first scene of the episode. I think it connects back to the very first scene we see the two of them, right? He's holding the soccer ball. And the very first scene we see in the 23rd Psalm is of the two of them playing soccer with a group of boys. So it's very much like these two brothers not only meeting each other again, but I think also going back to a place where things were less complicated, when things were more blissful, when they could just be unfettered kids playing soccer, you know, in the dirt, instead of having to deal with all this, that they go back to that despite all the complications, I think is beautiful. And I totally agree. I came into this podcast with the exact same read, that I don't know if it's as, you know, exact as, well, Echo is now doing this in his sideways universe, and then he meets Yemi, and then they move on together. But that scene to me not only closes the book of Mr. Echo, but it means to me like, it's almost like And They Lived Happily Ever After, in that these two, or at least in Echo's continuous quest to find Yemi, he finally was able to find him and realize what he needed to say to him. And despite how brutally thrashed this guy has been since the hatch blew up, emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually, his cup overflows.
Yeah. That's the cost of living. I think it's a really rich episode.
Yeah.
For me, Nikki and Powell are there. That sucks. But the richness of the episode for me, it's just been such a rewarding episode to always revisit. This is a very clean 4.2 for me, where I don't have to look over my shoulder and regret it. It's so fascinating to me. It's such a beautiful performance from Adewale, especially from a guy who was not at peace with his experience, mm-hmm. for the performance to be this good at the end, I think is really just spectacular from an actor who I've really appreciated for a very long time. We've touched on a lot. I do want to get a couple feedback questions in before we move on to the final business here. Daniel Brennan said, are you guys satisfied with Mr. Echo's arc on Lost? Had AAA been willing to remain on the show, where would you have liked to have seen his character fit in the end game? I think we talked about like a few of the directions we could have seen it go. I guess I do prefer this ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, just because like now I'm thinking about looking at what happened with Desmond and Ben. If the alternative was, let's take those storylines away from them and give them to Echo, I think we got the best of all possible worlds. I really do, where we got this beautiful way to send off this character in such like a weird yet satisfying context. Plus, Desmond gets to do all his freaky shit that ends up resulting in the constant. Plus, Ben has his own personal journey about faith to Jacob that ends up, you know, killing the person he worships and then realizing that he doesn't necessarily need to become the man in charge. Like, we have three fantastic character storylines now instead of just one. So it ended up being a really good thing.
This is from Dallin Servo. Echo mentions that Yemi's body is gone, similar to how Christian's body was missing. Does the man in black hide the bodies he decides to impersonate? Is that also why Bram and Alana take extreme measures to protect Locke's body in season 5 so they can have proof of the man in black's manipulations? I like that theory.
Yeah. I mean, there is a big old giant pit in the middle of the jungle where they can easily throw bodies onto. But yeah, I can imagine here, you know, when it comes to taking Christian's body, we talked about this during White Rabbit, that definitely seems like the smoke monster really effing with Jack when he's already at the end of his rope. That I can imagine still part of the con here is them being like, well, maybe this is Yemi because his body is gone. Otherwise, his body would be here, right? Like, you don't want Echo to be onto your plan until you give that turn with, you know, you talk to me as if I were your brother.
One more is from Eric Divestein. Did the others all have to make their own white robes, or are they standard issue when you join?
Listen, Juliet sews them all. The first, when you go into orientation, you have to give your tunic size to Juliet, and she'll make that for you and deliver it to your barrack.
That's very funny. let's get to the MVP LVPs. Mike, you've got three MVPs. I've got two. You've got three LVPs. I've got three LVPs. You've got two. I'm just going to, you know, Mr. Echo dies. Usually I give an LVP. No chance. I got to give him an MVP here. This is Adewale's swan song. Mm-hmm. He does such a great job. We're never going to get another chance to give or take a point for Mr. Echo. It's his only point of season 3. It's going to land him at a 16 overall. That's a lost number. Would have been anyway if it was a 15.
Yeah.
But it still feels good to put him there as he's going to end his run on Lost. At 16, still the decisive second place holder of the MVP LVP category.
I don't know. Do we dock a point next week when John looks at the message on his stick and it's super vague?
Maybe. Should have been like, all right, Locke, here's what you do. Maybe.
I'm going to give a point to the thing that kills Echo. It's been a while since we've done this, but I'm going to give a point to the monster here because now we can officially confirm this was the smoke monster. You know, I know the horse stuff is still ambiguous. I know that literally everything is the smoke monster, but the smoke monster gets one in over on Echo and beats the crap out of him. And maybe Locke does misinterpret his message to make him look more menacing than he does, but the monster is able to kill someone here.
Yeah, for sure. Points to the monster, props to the monster, advancing his agenda. I think we're both probably going to give an MVP point to this person, Juliet.
Yep, I'll add one onto there as well, much like a ketchup on a cheeseburger.
Yeah, where's the ketchup? Yeah, for all the reasons we've articulated, just an incredible Juliet episode. She is currently the season 3 leader, above Sawyer, who's at 4, Juliet's at 6.
Well, yeah, we were surprisingly Sawyerless this episode. I do believe there was a deleted scene where, thank God they cut this out, where they go back to the runway. After all this, I don't think we need to see Sawyer immediately after the events of Every Man for Himself, so I'm happy they cut that out. But I'm going to give my last MVP point to the recipient of the no ketchup burger. I'm going to give it to Jack here, because I feel like Jack, for the second episode in a row, continues his great streak of being onto the other scheme, seeing completely through Ben. I feel like Jack has the upper hand here, despite the fact that he is in such a subjugated position, and I want to give him kudos for it.
Yeah, so Jack, who's been languishing in the red, has just zeroed out. He's at 0 for the season right now, and is in the top 4 overall, still tied with Kate at 11 for Jack and 11 for Kate overall, and 0 for season 3 so far. LVP time, I think we're going to be lockstep on, you know, I have the bonus point. But Amika, screw you, you suck. Paolo takes a shit guy, you suck. I feel like you're going to be flinging doo-doo at Paolo as well.
Yep, doo-doo goes to Paolo and doo-doo goes to Amika as well.
Self-explanatory. And then I'll give the final LVP to Benjamin. I think Ben just bungles this one this week. It's not a good Ben week.
Yeah, I mean, listen, when you have Jack seeing right through you and then Juliet purposely scheming against you yet tricking you on the camera, not a good week. Because you know that Ben's in that you know, TV watching room nickying it the entire time.
And it's like, what are they watching? What is that? What are they talking about? What movie did she bring in?
Well, she did say to Kill a Mockingbird, so maybe he tuned out. Maybe he's not a huge fan of that.
It's like, oh, overrated. Speaking of overrated, am I overrating the cost of living with a 4.2? I'll tell you, it's far from the average, which is a 3.6. I will say the average for this episode is significantly brought down by alone 1.5.
Wow.
I will not identify the giver of the 1.5, other than to say I strongly disagree with the take that the 1.5 goes to the cost of living, because the cost of living is among, if not the worst episodes for this person in their ratings. But that is a very lonely 1.5. Everything else at the lowest is a 3.1. There are a couple of 4.2s. There's a 4.1. There are high threes as well here for the cost of living. This is just one of the episodes of Lost that I think about the most. If anything, it's just risen in my estimation after watching it this time. So it's a clean 4.2 for me.
Yeah, I was really going back and forth as to whether or not I liked this episode more than A Tale of Two Cities, which I was very high about. And I gave A Tale of Two Cities a 3.9. And I think especially after talking through it with you and especially seeing the value of the flashbacks, even if they were not as enjoyable as the 23rd Psalm, this is going to just edge out A Tale of Two Cities. So it's getting the straight 4.0. from me. I think this is very well done. I'm very satisfied with the way that they ended Echo's character. Feature some incredible scenes on Hydra Island. As I said, I think that Juliet tape scene might be the best Hydra Island scene that we get. I think it gets taken down a little bit because of the Nikki and Paolo of it all, and you definitely, especially in retrospect, see the shoehorning in that goes on a bit, especially from like the Locke's group perspective is a bit extraneous to everything. So I would not call it necessarily perfect, but a very well done episode. And I would definitively say, since we only have one more episode of this batch, I would say of these very much maligned first six episodes, definitely the best of the crop.
Yeah, not even a question as far as I'm concerned. But we will talk about that next week. I do. I love him, Laurel. I do. I love him for the man he wants to be and the man he almost is. I love him, Laurel. I love him. I assume we're talking Jerry Maguire. No.
I can only respond with, show me the Marzi.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, no. Instead, we're going to get a little bit of Captain Hammer here, Josh. Nathan Fillion is going to make his Lost debut. And, you know, we're really, I wouldn't say we're putting an end to the Hydra Island arc, but this is definitely, you know, a definitive stopping point for a lot of stuff. Look, this is going to be a tough follow-up. You know, we're going to get the Mr. Echo's funeral. We're going to get Kate and Sawyer really making their escape attempt. And of course, it's a Kate flashback episode. So we will see how Kate ends up ranking in the MVPs and LVPs, considering what usually happens with her in her centered episodes.
Yeah, I believe Taco Night is coming up. Taco Night on the menu in I Do. So get your feedback in next week. Down the hatch at postshowrecaps.com. We back, Mike, officially. Mr. Echo is gone, but Down the Hatch is back.
Yeah, and I'm so happy. You know, I know it was a wait, but I'm so happy to have you back in a number of ways, just to be able to expound about this episode. If we had to pick one episode to come back to after a bit of a hiatus, I'm happy it was this one, because there is so much to meditate on. And to be able to talk about an episode that I think, to the rankings point, just sort of like, you know, I think it varies as we sort of talked about, but I think it was a really refreshing episode to come back to, and especially to talk with you again. I miss getting to talk Lost with you, and hopefully, you know, people were not starved for content. Hopefully we're able to provide a bit of a cheeseburger instead of a nothing burger the past couple of weeks, but we're ready to keep moving forward an episode a week until we finish this whole bad boy up.
God willing. Oh my goodness. Do you believe? A something burger this week, indeed, I should say. We'll be back next week talking. I do. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.